Hello and welcome to the Analytic Show, the podcast of business through the lines of data science. But together, we'll dive into learning and sharing where various industries are heading and how data and analytics is at the heart of shaping business growth and productivity. Let's spark different ways of thinking about data and analytics that is relevant to you and prepare your business for future disruption. I'm your host, Jason Tan. I'm delighted you could make it on this journey with us. Hey guys, to continue to get support tips, techniques, and tools, and learn from the expert, hit that subscribe button wherever you are so we can keep in touch and continue our lifelong learning together. So, are you using your company data to its full potential? Take our embedded analytic assessment, find out your score. A leading organization like Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and Google have moved beyond dashboard and embedded data science directly into their daily business operation. With our 3-minute test, you will discover your potential in optimizing customer experience and revenue through embedded analytics. You will gain greater clarity, insight, and advice to embed analytics. Plus, you will receive customized results instantly. Find the link to this assessment in the description of this episode. Hello, 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 Sudo. Welcome to the Analytic Show podcast. I'm so excited to have you here today with Harry, where Harry and I is going to chat with you some of the works of the data analytic works that you are doing. Super excited to have you here.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks for the invite. A pleasure to be here.
Now, I'm going to say, Harry, thank you so much for co-hosting this episode with me and also making an intro to Sudowa. I am curious, how did you two come to know each other?
Yeah, I think it's a very good starting question. I think I've seen Sudowa in a couple of seminars, analytics related, and when I attended, I always look forward to his session. And I think during his session, I always interested to get good insights and what he experienced in his work, and what he shared really is relatable to me and as part of my work, and that is what I value most during his sessions. So I think we look forward to a good session today, Jason.
I certainly agree. Now I think the in-person event is back to around everywhere now. Are you planning any in-person events to the world?
Yes, there are quite a few. In fact, the US trip that I mentioned earlier, before we started this, is actually, I have a panel discussion over there. It's actually HIMSS, the Health Information Management and System Society. So it's a yearly conference, quite a big conference in the US. They have their Asia Pacific version as well. Which some of my colleagues actually attend. So there's one just next week.
Exciting. So what are you most looking forward to this particular event in the state?
I think it's a bit like if you go to an event like this, because it's a huge conference, to walk from one end of the conference area to the other end, it takes about half an hour. So there are many, many booths. We are all like children in a candy store, right? So you go in, there's so many candy, so many toys. It's actually quite fun and exciting because you get to see the latest and the greatest in health technologies. And especially for me, anything to do with data analytics and AI, there's quite a bit of excitement as well right now in the application of those in the space of healthcare.
All right. Well, now, before we start, I do have a couple of questions for you. I know you have worked across Southeast Asia, Greater China, India, Japan. Amazing. Of all of these places, what has been your experience like working in all these different countries?
My memory of business travel mainly is on confined spaces, airplanes, meeting rooms, hotel rooms.
No, I can relate to that.
but jokes aside, I feel that business travel really is a great opportunity to learn from my counterparts in other countries. And as a result of that connection, also identify opportunities for collaboration. I think that's very important because as we connect with one another, we get to learn from each other and we then identify opportunities where there are synergies, where it actually makes sense for us to work together for greater good.
Yeah. If given a choice, which country you would like to work in, or which country that give you a good impression and that you want to, sometimes I do want to spend time in that country. Yeah.
Well, this is a very tough question. Being a Singaporean, I'm actually quite used to the idea of traveling frequently. And I love actually all the different countries I've been in, whether for work or for leisure. I love being immersed in different culture, especially the food culture. But one country actually stands up quite recently, because recently a friend of mine told me about the first AI university in the world, the Mohammed bin Zayed University of AI in UAE. I was actually in Abu Dhabi in December. It was quite interesting. Given the country's focus in AI, I think it would be an interesting place to work for those of us who are in the AI space.
Wow. That is really interesting. Never realized that. I need to find out. Well, now, I understand that you are the director of the data analytics at the Ministry of Health in Singapore. Now, for those who are outside or not familiar with Singapore, do you want to tell us a little bit about the organization and itself? And before that, we will go into a little bit deeper later.
Sure. I don't want to bore everybody with too much detail, but really, the work in MOH in Singapore is encapsulated by the phrase better health, better care, better life.
Mm.
So through the Ministry of Health, Singapore government manages the public healthcare system to ensure that good and affordable basic medical services are available to all Singaporeans. So I think that really sums up the kind of work that we do in the ministry.
Right, I see. Sometimes I feel like healthcare is so complicated, and sometimes it really also boils down to the healthcare system, the policy in different country, and that really equally changed the whole thing, that how data analytics and also the organization. So before we go into the little bit more details about those things, I was hoping, do you mind to share with us a little bit more about the healthcare system in Singapore?
Yeah, sure. So healthcare system in Singapore, if you look at primary care, like when you look at GPs or general practitioners, family physicians, it's about 75% on the private sector, 25% public sector. That split is actually reverse if you look at hospital care. So for hospital care, the public sector actually has the lion's share of the market. In the intermediate and long-term care sector, it's a lot more fragmented with volunteer and welfare organizations, VWOs, private sector, and also those that are actually tied to our public healthcare institutions or clusters. So actually for intermediate and long-term care side, it's a lot more varied, but largely that's the kind of market share that we have in Singapore across the different care settings.
Those numbers were totally surprised to me. I was expecting that it's going to be the same regardless of what the segment is. But nevertheless, how do these things translate to your current role as the director of the data analytics at the MOH?
Okay, if tying back my role to the role of MOH, some of the things we do include projecting long-term healthcare demand. And I say long-term, it's minimally 10 years, if not 20, 30 years into the future. This allows us to plan for our healthcare capacity. For example, how many new hospitals to build, where to build them, how many doctors, how many nurses we want to train. In addition to that, we also analyze cost-effectiveness of health programs and interventions. This is to ensure that there's value for money on the use of public funds. We also do policy stimulations, for example, how to set the claim limits for MediShield Life. This is our universal healthcare insurance. It helps to improve affordability of healthcare services in Singapore.
Wow.
So, Tomo, if I may ask, what are some ways that data strategy can help Ministry of Health in Singapore to make a better decisions? I mean, for me, as from private healthcare, we do look up to the public healthcare as a for some initiative, the technological advancements, also the public healthcare in Singapore lead, as opposed to some other countries where private player will lead and the public will be lagging. But in Singapore, I see that as a reverse.
That's interesting. Wow.
Yeah. So if you look at our data strategy, it has two components. One is the use cases. The other one is the enablers. We align the use cases to our national priorities so as to ensure that we are working on the most important ones. So that's where the value is created. Once you execute the use case, that's where it unlocks value through the decisions that you make, through the actions that are taken as a result of the analysis that has been done. So that's one side of it, aligning that back to our national strategic priorities. On the enabler side, then, is really looking at how do we create reusable data access, for example, the right IT systems or IT products that allow us to be able to scale these use cases so that it doesn't stay as a little science experiment that people are doing.
Yeah, so if you can give some example of the use case on that store, I think that will be good.
Yeah. So one of the use cases that we have is when a patient actually go to a public hospital, we do then look at estimating the eventual bill size. That's important because we then want to know whether the patient is able to afford the healthcare services. If they can't, what will be the kind of financing schemes that are available to help them? So one project that we have really is to first assess the current method of bill size estimation, whether it's accurate. And then we actually found that there are some areas for improvement, and therefore looking at the application of machine learning techniques to allow us to be able to see whether there are room for us to improve the accuracy of the prediction so as to better help the patients to come to our public hospitals.
I see, that's interesting. I mean, in private healthcare, we also do similar things. I think it's always a challenge to predict the hospital bill as size, yeah, and especially with the some unexpected treatment that they may need during their stay. Those things, yeah.
That's really interesting. I wonder if that is opportunity to creating a benchmarking that could be also shared across the different area. Maybe share a different hospital, the public hospital, or maybe I wonder if that is something that would be considered as open data for the citizen of Singapore, where they have a better understanding about all these sort of things.
That's a very good point, Jason. In fact, we have this bill size publication. So we publish the bill sizes for selected procedures, and we make it available to the public. And therefore allows them hopefully make a better decision on where they may want to seek care depending on the affordability of the services.
On that note, one of the things that sometimes, and this is only my personal opinion, and this is an uneducated personal opinion about the healthcare system, is where I feel that sometimes with the insurance coming into the equation, it indirectly encourages the bill size to go higher and higher and higher over the time, because the incentive is really there for the patient to take it because insurance is going to pay that. I wonder if that's a similar case that apply in the public sector, where even that it is, I don't know, I do wonder what does that trend apply similar to what I was describing due to the private insurance?
Okay, so I think there are a few factors here, right? We must go back to, if you look at the doctors themselves, they always want to do the best for the patient.
Yeah.
And that means then sometimes having access to the latest and greatest in terms of treatment options available for the patient. However, some of these treatment options may be quite novel. It has not gone through a robust cost-effectiveness analysis, for example, because in ministry, we do have a health technology assessment to look at whether or not a treatment is cost-effective before we decide whether we want to subsidize it. So from a doctor's perspective, they just want to save the patient. And yeah. therefore, sometimes doctors may then prescribe certain treatment that may not be part of the subsidized list. And therefore, I think one way for us to look at that is to see how we can better identify the promising treatments out there and as much as possible, try to do the health technology assessment so that then we can identify the ones that are potentially can benefit a larger set of people in the population and therefore may justify maybe having the ministry subsidize some of this treatment. Hopefully then that actually help to improve the affordability of the treatment to the individuals. So that's one side of it. Of course, we're also looking at how then we can go upstream. In the first place, we look at prevention, how we look at health promotion, which is what Healthier SG is about. I'm not sure whether you've heard of it, Jason. It's one of the latest initiatives that we have in the Ministry of Health in Singapore, really going upstream and encouraging individuals to form or to build a relationship with their GPs, with their family physicians, and to actually have a relationship that goes beyond just the curative aspect. No, it doesn't mean that when I'm sick, then I go to my GP. It's really then to talk also about how I keep myself in good health. If I have chronic diseases, how do I then manage them in a better way so that there will be less complications arising from my chronic conditions? So I think that's one thing that we all want to do, to move further upstream to do prevention, do better health promotion, and hopefully downstream, we'll have less need for many of these expensive healthcare services that's needed by our individuals in Singapore.
You can add into Sutowo's point on the novel, sometimes treatment. I think that what inspires, I think, some of our private healthcare also to initiate a value-driven outcome. So whenever we see a novel treatment, but it gives a better result, then why not? I think the ministry is right in considering some of the alternative and compare the result. And even though it may look expensive, but it gives you so much better, then the value is there. Right?
Now, on that note, with all of this initiative, whether it's the public policy or the private sector, so how do you then to ensure that your data strategy is aligned with all of these goals and the objectives then?
I think the key really is prioritization. We have a prioritization framework that allows us not just to identify the use cases that are aligned to our national priorities, it also allows us to identify those with a larger impact and easier to implement. So by doing that, then it ensures that we are focusing our effort on the use cases that are actually helping us not just aligned with our national priorities, but also the ones that will deliver as much impact as possible within the time frame that we have to execute the use case.
Right, I see. It's really interesting. I think sometimes I feel like when the initiative is so large, it becomes really hard to be able to link the data and link to this vision. That is, I think, sometimes the bit that I struggle with. Is there any particular tactics or strategy that you would use that you can share to bring these two things together, especially when that is such a big vision and big initiative?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question, Jason. One way we do that is through what we call a theory of change. So whenever we want to do an initiative, there is a theory of change that is developed. And then in that theory of change, then we look at what are the objectives that we are trying to achieve for the initiative, how then the different interventions are actually supposed to affect and help to move the needle on the objectives that we have. And as a result, what are some of the indicators that we want to measure for those interventions to know whether we are on the right track, whether we are achieving the right result. So it goes back a lot to this theory of change. And when we have big healthcare initiatives or programs, there will definitely be a theory of change, and we have a structured framework that allows us to do that.
Right, I see. And with you able to track this sort of a theory of change, I suppose it would be enable you to ask for the budget when it comes to the budgeting time.
Yes, yes. And also an estimation of the benefits that you're going to get out of the initiative. So based on the theory of change, what are some of the things that we can achieve as a result of the initiatives or the program? And based on that, then looking at sizing the right level of resourcing needed to get that going. Of course, then the cost-benefit analysis is important. It has to pass that test before then we go about it.
Based on your experience so far of working at the MOH all this year, what do you feel like is the have you developed your own framework in terms of developing a winning data strategy, like to manage the public healthcare or perhaps the public sector?
I think apart from, we've spoken quite a bit about aligning with organization's strategic priorities. I think another aspect to consider for a winning data strategy really is that it should be grounded on the people who are using the data, as well as those who are benefiting from the use of data. So take, for example, our data strategy was developed in part through interviews with about 200 stakeholders across the entire public healthcare family. We have identified the pain points from these interviews across all data life cycle stages, all the way from data acquisition, data management, data access, distribution, and down to data exploitation. So grounding it on the people whom we are serving, I think is an important step for us to look at how a winning data strategy should be.
I think on the other note, I'm curious to know what are some of the common pitfalls or the challenges that you have experienced in the past?
Yeah, so I think in terms of pitfalls, there are quite a few. Maybe some of them are more misconceptions that people have, right? One misconception that I often see is that you need perfect data to get started.
Yes.
So in data analytics, actually, perfect is the enemy of good. Often, we only need good enough data to start an analytics project or AI project. So there's no such thing as perfect data. Another misconception that I often hear about is that the more data, the merrier. Actually, similar to the concept of a minimum viable product, we should apply the same concept into the data space in terms of minimal viable data. I think there's quite a bit of burden of data collection and management, and not all data is created equal. Some are more useful than others. So let me give you an example. There's this solution called Curate AI that is from NUS, developed by my friend, Professor Din Ho. It is an AI tool that identifies and allows clinicians to determine the optimal dose of chemotherapy for cancer patients. And this is done using only the data of the patient. There's no need for big data. And they found that for some patients, after doing the analysis, they were able to turn the non-respondents to respondents by actually reducing the dose of the chemotherapy. Not by increasing the dose, by reducing the dose. So it's interesting. And that is actually based on small data, the data from the patient. And we don't need big data for that. So I think that is one example to illustrate that it doesn't mean that the more data, the better. Sometimes we only need a smaller set of data, and that is far easier for us to do the maintenance of the model, far easier for us to do the data management needed in order to actually maintain the model.
I certainly agree with that. I think from the years of working in the data and the analytics, I so agree with what Javier is just saying. Now, you spoke about AI. I think AI has been going, taking all the headline of the newspaper for the last 6 months, especially with the ChatGPT. Has that got any impact in terms of in your organization where there is this need or rush or urgency to wanting to do more AI from the ground?
Absolutely. I think there's a lot of excitement, as you have pointed out, as a result of ChatGPT. I think it's a good thing. While there's quite a bit of hype on it, I think overall trend is a good one because that gets people more aware of the power of AI and also get people more interested in this area and wanting to try it out. I think the good thing that comes out for me is that people are then willing to experiment and look at how we can then use AI in many of the work. That can actually range from many things, right? Yesterday, I just had a discussion with quite a few colleagues from different government agencies. The use cases can range from writing a job description, for example, right? To in the healthcare side, looking at perhaps even doing the first draft of a discharge summary for the patients. So there are many different kinds. And if you look at chatbots in general, thus far, I think many of the underlying technologies that are used to develop the chatbot has quite a fair bit of areas for improvement. And I think what we have seen from the power of ChatGPT, really, if it can be used, harnessed in the right way, for example, the powers of the chatbots that we have in healthcare, I think that will be very helpful.
I agree. I already know my engineering. I know that my engineering team already using it to help coding. Like for example, if we are not sure what exactly the code is doing, we just pump it in and then ask it to explain for us, or sometimes even help correcting the error for us.
Yeah, Jason and Chutoa, I think for especially on the AI on the large language models, I think there has been a lot of interest. And in this space, I see that there are a couple of potential areas, like for example, in our knowledge management, like the way people can understand the policy documents. I mean, in a hospital, there's hundreds or even thousands of policy documents that you may need to adhere to, right? And the other thing is probably on the customer support, where like our call center, those things, right? If we can alleviate some of the tasks that need to be handled by human to answer common questions, I think that will be very good. May I know, like in the government sector, Sutowo, has there been any like initiative around that area?
Yes. There have been quite a few initiatives. In fact, similar to what you've just shared, there is a policy document around IT and data in the government. So actually, many of my colleagues have been grappling with the policies, because if you want to implement an IT system, you have to comply with the policy. And the understanding of the policy sometimes is lacking. So my colleagues in GovTech has recently created a Q&A engine based on that policy. And that's useful because internally, then we can ask questions around the policies and then we get an answer from that. So that serves as the first level understanding of the policy. Of course, you still have to check with colleagues who actually know the policy before you go about actually implementing some of the IT systems. But I think it helps to reduce the load and the burden on many of the colleagues who are experts in the policy.
Certainly, yeah. I think the way we do that, I think I've seen a lot of examples, even the one that I'm trying internally, where when we ask the chatbot, which is based on the OpenAI GPT model, to answer, they are able to cite the policy document as a link, right? This is the base of the answer. I think that will be good, so that it will also educate us in a way, chatting with our own data to understand about our own policy, things like that.
Absolutely. One of the risks is really the hallucination that we are seeing in ChatGPT. Right? And to Harry's point, I think it's important for us to, if we can then cite the link or have a link to the actual document of that policy, that actually the basis for the answer, I think it's very helpful, because then it gives people the confidence that it is not the ChatGPT hallucinating.
Correct. Yeah, not just
the incorrect answer.
Creativity of words sounds coherent, but the correctness or the there's no it's not really a correct answer. Right?
Yeah. Sorry, I interrupted you, Jason.
Oh no, I was gonna say that the is actually something that you have already talked about, which is the hallucination. So I think part of the development in that area that I'm seeing is that there are a lot of companies now using the ChatGPT there's this model called embedding. So the whole idea is that to push all of this knowledge data into the vector database and then use the embedding to do the information retrieval to get the information. So that way you can keep them to stay on point. Because I think one of the things that where a lot of people seem to be missing and also get carried away with all of these assignments of the ChatGPT is like, it just magically call out all those things. But I think the really one of the super advanced, the milestone that we have got this technology is that the information retrieval coming with together with this unstructured data is so much powerful. It's amazingly powerful. I think that is the area that is so worthwhile watching.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And the other thing is the vector database. I think that is so many areas, so many companies are trying to do that now. So it will be interesting to see what is happening. But on that note, I think one of the questions that often popping up with the ChatGPT is the ethical and the privacy of the customer, of the data, all those sort of things. I am sure that it is one thing that you guys are taking it seriously at MOH. Based on your experience doing the ethical and the privacy of all of this data, any experience or advice that you want to share with the listener, how they should really consider this aspect?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. Data privacy and security are very important considerations, as you have pointed out, for many organizations, especially for highly regulated ones, such as financial services, healthcare, where that's especially more important. We use the five SAFEs framework. So it stands for safe data, safe setting, safe people, safe project, and safe output. So safe data really is the data, for example, sufficiently anonymized to prevent re-identification. Safe setting, do we have sufficient controls and protection on the IT system itself? Safe people, are these the users who are authorized and given the appropriate access level? On the safe project side, are these the approved projects that have passed legal and ethics assessment? Safe output, what do we allow the users to export out of their IT workspace, for example? So we use that five safe framework to help us manage the data protection aspect. We have also started to look into privacy enhancing technologies to develop methods that will maintain the privacy of the patients whose data are being used in many of the models that are being built. So for example, we are piloting the combined use of federated learning and confidential computing with our national research agency, ASTAR. And in building AI or machine learning model, we typically pull the data together at a common location, which is we bring the data to the model. Right? By federated learning, really, we are bringing a model to the data. So there's no need for the data contributors to send data to each other. And the models are then built on the different data sets and combined together after that.
One of the interesting developments that I often read is the synthetic data. So basically, rather than using the real data, they basically just generate a bunch of the data themselves for the testing. Is that something that you guys are experiencing just to take the privacy guardrail to the next level?
Yeah. I think the synthetic data has many uses, one of which is as a form of exploration. For example, different organizations may want to request more data for certain assessment because synthetic data is actually from the statistical distribution is very similar to the actual data set itself. Although if you look at individual records, it's not the real record of an individual. And therefore, if you look at the trend for a population, for example, it is quite representative of the population. And for companies who actually want to have access to some data that some other organizations may not be willing to share, then the use of synthetic data could be still helpful as a first step for them to have a better understanding of the profile of the people whom they may want to target. Another area really is to look at potentially augmenting data that is lacking. Like, for example, if you talk about rare diseases, we'll have very few cases, especially in a country like Singapore, where the population is very small. So the use of synthetic data can help us in a way, quote unquote, complete the data set so that then it's more, it's better and more representative for us to be able to build a model around it. So I think there are many uses of synthetic data. It's just that we are just in a way scratching the surface of it. And I think there'll be more and more use cases coming up from that.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So, Tawo, is there any project that you would like to highlight that have shown potentially great benefit for Singaporeans? I just now I heard about the oncology thing that you mentioned, where they reduced the concoction of the medication, and yet it's still, you know, more effective rather than increasing the dose. I think that is one of the interesting project. Maybe you can name one or other few projects.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Harry. One such project is the Selena Plus. It stands for Singapore Eye Lesion Analyzer. It is an AI system that detects diabetic retinopathy from retinal scans. This project has been rolled out nationwide to all 23 polyclinics, which is our subsidized primary care facility in Singapore. This has allowed us to provide early intervention and help us overcome shortage of trained healthcare professionals who can detect such high-risk patients so that we can do that early and prevent future blindness.
That's a great example. Yeah. Then maybe as one of the closing questions that we'd like to ask you as an analytics expert, what advice would you give to companies that are just starting to develop their data strategy and trying to determine where to play and how to win the market or improve on their business decision-making?
Yeah, so I think this is a great question. First and foremost, focus on the most strategic business priority. I think that's very important. We've talked about quite a fair bit of that during this session. Data has to create value. Right? And it can only create value when you actually turn that into insights, into decision and ultimately action. So I think that bias towards action is important so that then we can actually generate value out of data. As I said earlier also, I think important to make life easier for people who are using the data so that then we reduce the pain points that will then hopefully lubricate the entire data machinery and people want to use data more and more. It's also important to remember that not all data is created equal, or there's actually quite a bit of burden on data collection and management. So where possible, go for minimum viable data that is much easier to maintain.
That is wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think I have learned so much more about the data strategy from the public sector view, and I also running a public healthcare sector. Now, these are my two go-to questions for every single of my guests. The first one first is, what is your most important first principle?
Wow. Okay. The most important first principle for me really is be curious. Learn about the business, learn about the people, especially how people work, how people make decisions. I think that's important because it is with this context and understanding that we can make data useful, at least as a data practitioners, that's how I look at it. And also, it's important to dive deeper, especially when data and anecdotes are not consistent. If you look at Amazon, actually, which is a very famous company that's very data-driven, their founder, Jeff Bezos, actually has this saying, right? When the data and anecdotes do not agree with each other, you trust the anecdotes, not the data. Because sometimes if you use, for example, averages in data, it's actually quite misleading. On average, many of our customers may be satisfied with your products and services, but there may be certain segments who are using a particular subset of the product or certain products or services that may be very unsatisfied because of certain challenges that they face. So I think go beyond the averages, have that curiosity to actually interrogate the data further and complement that with some of the anecdotes that you get from human stories and feedback that you get, that will be very helpful in getting a more complete picture of what the actual situation is.
I love your suggestion about be curious about the people and learn about the people. I find that as an engineer is not something that comes natural to me and some of the engineers that I have met. What would be your advice to the engineer like myself, or the engineer like myself 10 years ago, to pay more attention and to pick up a little bit more skill set to learn and be curious more about people, whether it's the counterpart that they work with or whether it's the customer that they are solving the problem for?
Yeah, so this is a something that would have benefited me as well in the past, because I'm also an engineer by training. So more comfortable with machines, with algorithms than with people. Actually, it was interesting because earlier in my career, I had a client when I was in consulting who actually introduced this book to me. It's called Never Eat Alone by Keith Ferrazzi. So actually amazing things happen when people work together. Furthermore, actually, some studies have shown that people who tend to eat alone are 3 times more likely to suffer from metabolic syndromes than those who have company.
Interesting.
So if there's one good reason why we want to then get to know more people, be curious about the individuals, I think starting by having meals with people and having a good conversation, I think is a very good starting point.
That is a good one. I think I may have heard of that book before, but I never read it. I have to pick it up, and I probably should have buy a few of them to share with people. Now, my next question that I actually going to ask, and I feel like maybe that's the exactly the same answer you're going to give to me, is what is one book that you have read and thought it would have been better for your younger self? Is it the same book?
Yes, it's the same book. I actually read quite a fair bit. It's that book, I think, is quite fundamental and tied back to the first principle that's quite important to me that I hold quite dearly, which is being curious. I think the curiosity is not just about content, about knowledge. It's also about people. I think it's important for us to remember that, and it's that connection with people that is really important that creates value. If I may digress a little bit, actually, a lot of people speak about data as the new oil. I think data is a lot more like people. When you link them together, link different data sets together, that's where you get a lot of value. A lot more value than the data as a standalone asset. And that's very similar to people, because as we connect with one another, we learn from each other, we identify opportunities for collaboration, and that's where we can create even more value than if we were to work on our own alone. It's really about that. Be curious. Not just about the knowledge and the content, but also with the people around you. You can learn a lot from that.
So true. So true. Well, thank you so much for this session, sharing a lot of these things and also some of the advice for the engineer. I love it. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jason. Thank you so much, Harry.
Yeah, thanks.
Hey, guys, I got something really exciting from my friend at the Australian Computer Society to share with you. Now, ACS, they are going to run a Queensland State Tech Summit for the 2023. And I think this is a really, really good opportunity to network with some of the brightest minds in the industry, but also more importantly, I think hear some of the ground success story and the example from the Queensland Tech professional. Now, the event is going to take place on the 26th May of 2023 at Cloudland 43. Now, this is a lovely place for those of you who have been there. Now, the previous event is really a perfect opportunity for those technology enthusiasts to come together to learn from some of the industry experts. I know some of my friends actually is going to be there and speak and share their idea and experience. So I highly, highly recommend that to join this event. Now, with a diverse range of speakers, including some of the top leaders in the tech industry, so you really can expect to gain insight on topics like the cybersecurity, local approach to the inclusive tech leadership, low-code gaming technology, obviously data, analytic AI, and also really interesting is the space technology. And for those who are not familiar, in Queensland, we actually have quite a few of prominent space startup in Queensland. So, and obviously with more to come. So, but that's not all. I think that is also excited to announce that we also have some photo booth where you can really get your headshot for your LinkedIn profile taken for you on the day. Now, this is really, really important or useful, especially if you are active on LinkedIn, and to showcase the best of you on LinkedIn for your potential employer or customer if you are doing a lot of business development work. Now, finally, that is also opportunity to explore some of the script for the table and also network with your fellow attendee. Now, register today for early bird tickets. And if you are not an ACS member, use the promotional code of the Analytics Show listener. Is ACSTAS. I repeat again, ACSTAS at the registration page to save $125 off the event ticket and join us at the ACS Queensland State Summit 2022. So I look forward to seeing you there. If you have any questions, I'll just give you a shout out or give ACS a shout out. I will share the discount code on the LinkedIn post are also in the email as well. See you there. Bye. If you enjoyed this conversation, hit that subscribe button so we can meet again. If you don't, I'll be stuck in an infinite loop. So pull that part by clicking the subscribe and help me out. You can further support us by leaving us a kind review from wherever you are listening. At the end of the year, I will choose a reviewer to send a special gift to, and it might just be you. Look forward to seeing you here next week for a new adventure. If I can find my way out of this endless loop. See ya.